Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
Good afternoon, and thanks to Ian Daborn for taking us through from 10 o'clock. Keep applying that sun cream, Ian. You're lucky you're not in Portugal or southern Spain. Whew, but welcome to Flavour, and we are bringing you an hour of local food and drink. I am Matt Bentman, and I am here live in the studio with Alan Alder and Dr. Sue Bailey.
And today we celebrate the continuing hot weather with a barbecue special. More about that in a moment. And we also visit the Cambridge Preserves kitchen.
We speak with Samira Effer, who's taken over at Alimentum, about the changes he's bringing about. On a less cheery note, we find out about rising vegetable prices too.
But to counter that slightly, we will also be bringing you news of free food where you can go and pick up in the Cambridge area. And Dave Fox will be talking about planting your own crops. We'll also have the food and drink news at the end, but first, let's talk barbecues. Alan?
Yeah, very timely. There's lots of barbecuing going on in Cambridge's green spaces. I caught up with these two barbecuers on Lammers Land early in the week.
What have you had on your barbecue?
Salt and pepper beef burgers, weren't they?
Yeah.
And halloumi?
Yeah, halloumi.
And bread rolls.
And beef kofte kebabs.
Beef kofte kebabs. Yeah.
Wow, were they good?
Lovely.
What's beef kebab like?
We can show you one. We've saved one.
Don't start getting out of the habit. It's a kofta. Like, you know, like they've got meat and scrunched it all up on a stick. You know, like a kebab.
Right.
Yeah.
Have you ever had any barbecue disasters?
No, well, because I'll eat anything. Oh, yeah, if it doesn't light, that would be a disaster. If you've brought a disposable out and you can't get it lit, that would be pretty disastrous.
Well, have you got any barbecue tips?
No, because the disposable ones are easy light, yeah. That and stick to beef and lamb so you don't get food poisoning. Just leave the chicken and pork at home.
If you wonder about the green spaces, you see that most barbecuing is on disposable barbecues, and it's easy to understand why. No worries about lighting, they're easy to carry, and you can buy prepared food that will work on them. But what if you want to use a bigger range of food, or be more ambitious, like barbecuing ribs from scratch maybe? How do you do it? What charcoal is best? How do you light it? How long does it all take? And what about food safety? I asked Vladimir Hromek from Smokeworks and Roger Frost, ex-Cambridge 105, for some tips. Roger first, at his barbecue, pointing out another potential difficulty.
Well, the same rules that you might apply in any kitchen for cooking things will also apply here. So, but also with some surprises, which is you thought the sausages were going to take 15 minutes, but you discovered they were black after three.
Vlad explains.
The heat on the barbecue, a lot of people are tempted to make it really, really hot. But what you want to go is medium, low to medium heat. So if you think about your burner in a kitchen, you want it to have it, and your settings is 1 to 6. You want it to have it about 2 to 3.
Now, there is advice on gauging the temperature of your barbecue. If you hold your hand about 12.5 centimetres above it, and you can hold your hand there for only 1 to 2 seconds, then those coals are hot. 3 to 4 seconds, medium hot. So you ought to aim for round about, say, 4 seconds. Or you could get a temperature probe.
Okay. You can always get yourself a little probe. I mean, dig the probe in at 75 or above, and you know precisely whether they're cooked or not.
Yeah. Another way of gauging the doneness, certainly of steaks, is by looking and touching. There are a couple of ways of estimating how well something is done simply by touching it. One is, if you touch your cheek, if you push your finger into your cheek, then that feels the same as a rare steak. Your finger into the front of your chin, that feels like a medium steak. And if you push your fingers onto your forehead, then that's how a well-done steak feels. Here's Roger Frost.
The advice on steaks that I have always followed is that the thicker steaks work better and the thin ones kind of shrivel up too quickly. So you'd better be either keeping a real big, good eye on them or just go for the thicker steaks.
Now, some barbecuers, the advanced ones, go for what's known as the smoke ring.
The barbecue kind of intelligentsia talk about kind of getting a bark of crustiness on the outside of a steak, and then a sort of an inner in a ring of stuff and then a kind of a ready bit on the inside. They talk about things called a smoke ring, which is some chemistry that takes place in the meat.
But what is essential is good charcoal. And Vlad here explains the problem with cheap charcoal.
In the restaurants, we generally use big K brand chunks or briquettes. Our main reason for that is it gives you a long-lasting heat. So what often happens is that we try to barbecue on the coal too early because we worry that all that heat will be gone. Now, what you should really do is wait till all the coal turns silver, almost ashy color, and then start putting your sausages or your chickens or whatever you're barbecuing on. Now, the cheap and cheerful a coal will give you the burst of the heat, but actually after that there is not much heat left. Now that's why you end up with charred or burned things, because that's not a time you should be barbecuing. You should wait till that first phase is gone, and there should be enough heat left within that sort of coal to start cooking on it. The newest trend is now the coconut husks, because it gives you really long lasting heat.
But the first problem with charcoal is lighting it.
The way how we do it in a restaurant, we would use a restaurant grade, a kitchen grade gas blowtorch, and you hold it 30-40 centimeters from the coal. And you get them lit, you know, it takes about a minute, minute and a half. You go around, you build up a pyramid from the coal, and then obviously you light the bottom, which then eventually will light it. Now at home, I would probably recommend using fire lighters, getting them to the a bottom, so as you build up a pyramid, so you do like a circle, and then you put your fire starters around on the top of it, and then you put the rest of the pyramid on top, so they kind of embedded in there, right. And then you start them off. And I mean, the biggest problem with the starting the fire is that people poke it too much. you should start it and let it be. Let it do its own thing. The more you poke it, the worse it gets.
Okay, so you've got your coals lit. But where do you put them?
The ones they sort of white, the ones they turn into sort of ash colour coals, you spread it around at that part, those two-thirds, and you leave the last third of the barbecue for your resting ingredient space. So those two-thirds is your direct grilling area. That's where you put your sausages, your chickens. That's where you get them direct above the heat. That's where you get your color. That's where you get your char on them. And then once you're happy with that, the way how it looks, the way how it, you know, feels, then you put it for at least 5 to 10 minutes into that area, which we call the indirect grilling. So that's like your resting area to cook them through. Now, in that point, I would put a lid on it, just leave them there, sit, just to cook through.
Right, and you leave them alone.
You leave them alone, don't touch them.
The resting, what's the purpose of that? Is it to get the insides properly cooked?
Yes, I mean, obviously, direct grilling is it can be quite aggressive if you, on occasions, get your temperature too high. It might be looked like it's cooked from the outside, but actually inside it might be still not cooked through. So that is to ensure that everything is cooked through. So you do your chicken breast 10 minutes on each side, or what it really depends on how hot you made your barbecue. But then you leave it sitting in that area to ensure that it cooked through, and as well the fibers within the meat will relax. So it will result in a juicier and more tender product.
Okay. Back to timing for a moment. What about ribs done entirely on the barbecue with no pre-cooking?
In America, they'll do what's called a 3-to-1 method. So, I mean, you can adjust it depending on what you want. So some people are doing 2-to-1s. It refers to hours, how many you smoke it. So that's 3 hours you smoke it for. And then your 2 hours you foil it. So that's the tenderizing bit of the smoking process. And then the last hour, you take it out of the foil, you glaze it, or you put the barbecue sauce on it, and you put it back onto the grill. Now we're talking about different temperatures of the grill than when you're direct grilling. So when you're direct grilling, your barbecue is hot. Now, when you're smoking your ribs, now you're looking in around those 110 degrees, so it's a lot lower. It's not suitable for direct grilling. So you're talking about, I think it's 228, 225 Fahrenheit, somewhere thereabouts. Take your membrane off, you use any rubs, either you make it yourself or you buy one pre-made. You rub those ribs, you can leave them overnight, or you can just rub them and put them straight on the barbecue. It depends how much love you want to give it. It's completely up to you. And then you either put them sort of directly on a barbecue, you can buy rib racks, and you put those ribs in between, leave them there for 3 hours, obviously maintaining the temperature about 110, 115, for 3 hours, 115 degrees Celsius. Then you take a foil, you rub your ribs with the foil, that's where, you know, you tenderize them. Now, the ingredients they'll put in the foil would be something like apple juice, if you're doing a pork ribs, apple vinegar, cider vinegar, brown sugar, barbecue sauce, a little bit more of a rub, whatever takes your fancy. It's really, you can create your own signature ribs by that. Now, you do it in a tight package, and so there's no steam coming out of it, nothing's dripping away, so you wrap those ribs up and put them back onto a grill at the same temperature. You'll be still going for about 110-115 degrees Celsius. Leave them there for next 2 hours. That's the 3-2-1 method. So 3 hours smoke, 2 hours in a foil, and then once the 2 hours are passed, you take them gently out, they'll be very tender. You put them back onto a grill to that finish smoke and finish sort of getting that final touch onto it for an hour. In this time, you can put the barbecue sauce on it to glaze them, or you can leave them dry rub, whatever. Again, you know, it's up to preference,
right?
And they should be done.
And those processes are using which part of the barbecue, the direct or the indirect?
So if you're smoking ribs, that would be completely indirect,
right?
Grilling, and there will be a lot less charcoal or wood, depends what you're using.
Yeah.
Then it
and that's why you've got
coal.
That lower temperature, because
yes.
You're away from the coals.
So obviously, yeah. You're looking for that lower temperature, but lower lasting temperature.
Sure.
When we think of barbecues, I think most of us think of meat. There are alternatives, as Vlad explains.
Things like a corn in a husk, it's really delicious. Things like butternut squash, it can really, if you just slice it into the chunks, you don't even need to peel it off, because the peel will come at the end. Just grill it from the both sides till it's tender. You know, obvious things like courgettes, onions inside of their skins. You can do whole cauliflowers. I just need to keep basting them with the butter or some sort of a base. So that would be your indirect grilling. Again, you can do the whole cauliflower. You can cut cauliflower into a steaks if you leave the stalks on and just direct grill that. Beetroots are great. You know, just rub them into foil, or not even that, just rub them in a little bit of a salt and olive oil and leave them there on the grill, and then you just peel the skin off. So there is a lot of possibilities.
A lot of people are very concerned about hygiene as far as barbecues is concerned, and rightly so. Here's Roger Frost.
I make sure, for example, that these tongs here are different to the tongs on this side. So these tongs are the tongs I use to pick up the raw meat and slap it down. And these tongs are the tongs I use to turn the thing over if I want to turn it over.
How much is a good helping at a barbecue? Here's a novel approach.
I think outside and alcohol and good friends and various amounts of nervousness all contribute to you eating more. So my kind of a guess portion for eating meat is 200 and something, 250 grams, should we say, a mug. If you were to get a steak and to cram it into a mug, that would be 250 grams of steak.
Eight
about
ounces.
8 ounces,
yeah.
If you're in old stuff. And for the other stuff, you know, the side things, about 100 grams for a portion of green stuff.
And barbecues are not just the preserve of males.
What have you got on your barbecue?
Indian-style chicken skewers.
And are they good?
Yeah, I think it's not bad, yeah.
And it's all worked well? You haven't burnt anything?
Not yet.
Do you ever burn things on a barbecue?
If I'm around, it's
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Hello.
Hi.
Jasmine.
Hi, I'm Alan. Does he ever burn things on barbecues?
No, it's normally I'm doing the barbecuing, so it's okay if I'm around.
Right, but if he's left by himself?
It would.
Health and safety hazard.
Must have the wife around.
Well, thanks to that couple for halting my sexist assumptions. Actually, the chap was at the barbecue and his wife was some way off when I got there. I risked my case. Thanks also to Vladimir Hromek from Smokeworks and Roger Frost for their ideas. I found it all very inspiring.
Inspiring enough to have a barbecue?
Yes, actually. I went home and had a barbecue. I did the wrong thing. You know, Vladimir talks about getting decent coal. I went to my local shop and they didn't have the type that he recommended. So I went to the petrol station and they didn't either. Mm. So I ended up getting stuff that didn't stay lit for long enough. And it was actually a disaster.
Oh dear.
So the thing is, follow his advice and get decent coal.
Mm.
Lesson one. What about you? Are you a barbecuer?
Well, we have a thatched cottage, so actually that's a bit dangerous. I want to try and find out one of these green eggs, though, because that might be worth having a go.
Yeah.
And also, my daughter's fiancé is a supreme barbecuer, so we leave it all to him.
Oh, that's
brilliant.
By the way, we visited La Paz in Bolivia a few years ago, which is, you know, at an astonishingly high altitude. We were doing a tour, a little walking tour, and the person taking us around said we would never see anybody barbecuing anything in La Paz.
And
I couldn't imagine why. And she said, because the air is so thin, the atmosphere is so thin, there isn't enough oxygen, and it's just almost impossible to get them to light.
Good grief, how fascinating. Don't do barbecue up a mountain, then.
No.
Anyway, the hot weather may be good for barbecues, but it's not good for our pockets. Here's Chris from Cambridge Market talking with Alan about prices.
Chris, people are saying that the price of food is going to go up because of the drought. Any idea what?
Any root crops that are coming through in the next few weeks or few months will need lots of irrigation. Those that aren't irrigated, the weight of the crop will go down, so the price will go up. I'm talking potatoes, parsnips, carrots, swedes, anything like that. Anything that's in the ground now growing for probably October, November, December could be in short supply.
Right, what about things like runner beans? Are they being affected now?
Yeah, they are. Runner beans usually need showers to set the flower and grow. And of course, if you're not watering regularly, the flowers just drop off, so the yield will be down.
Right. Anything else affected in that way?
Peas, again. They need a good constant supply of water. Usually peas grow in Yorkshire and Worcestershire around here because they get more rain than we do.
Right.
But even there's a drought, and so the pea crop has dried up in the field, basically.
Yeah. What sort of price rises are we looking at in percentage terms, say?
Oh, probably 30% on things like peas and runner beans, yeah. I think some of the pea crop is virtually finished now, whereas it would go well into August, usually, especially if there's a supply of rain.
Yeah. And what about the root crops you mentioned before? How much do you think they might go up by?
Well, last year, potatoes were making no money at all. They even left some in the field because the price was so low. This year, I can see the price of your chips in the chip shop going up this year.
What about my potatoes from your store?
I'm sure we'll keep price rises to a minimum and cut our profits.
Thank you. you're very kind.
So, food prices with the combined effects of Brexit and the weather are not looking good. Chris, by the way, has the fruit and vegetables stall that's about a third of the way along from the Guildhall, opposite Gap, a very knowledgeable person. And after the next feature, news of some free food.
The Cambridge Preserves Kitchen started a couple of years ago. It's run by Amanda Randall, who makes a variety of jams, chutneys and jellies. Here she is now.
I love this quote. The best jam is made at home. Likewise, marmalade and chutney. You simply cannot buy anything to touch homemade, however much you pay. And of course, everything you do is homemade.
Yes, indeed it is. I love that. That's exactly it. I did a piece for the Cambridge magazine last year. One of the questions was, what's the most important thing? And I thought, do you know what time is? Time is the most important thing. You don't rush, especially chutney. You do not rush it. Well, I don't. You need to check over your fruit. You can't just whack any old rubbish in because it shows. So yeah, I think that is absolutely right. It is about being at home, cooking at home at that pace. So I'll do, say, a couple of jam pans at a time. I might end up with, out of one batch, 30, 35 jars if I'm lucky, depending on what it is, because everything, all fruit produces at a different level, so you'll get much less cherry jam than you will plum jam, say.
Yeah.
Even though it's 3 kilos of each, 4 kilos of each, you'll still get tons of plum jam, but not so much cherry jam. I've got one lady who, I made some strawberry and lemon verbena jam last year, because I had strawberries, everyone's going, where's the strawberry jam? I was like, I haven't got any. And I happened to be in the garden. Oh, I've got lemon verbena. I've got a lovely, beautiful, big plant of lemon verbena. I bet they're nice together. And they are. And one lady, she just bought the whole lot. I made some more, and she just bought that lot too. Because she couldn't resist it. And she still is asking me, this was last year, where's your strawberry and lemon verbena jam? Well, I haven't made any, so I'm hiding from her. But there are various people like that. Crabapple and rowan jelly, that's another thing that I sell lock, stock and barrel to one person. She buys the lot.
The thing that really got you started was a particular apple, the golden noble.
Yeah. There's a cute little house just up the road from me. Every year there would be these beautiful golden nobles, very light yellow, and they go to froth when you cook them. They're just delicious. And they would just be free in a box. So we used to collect them and go home and make stuff with them, you know, crumbles and all that kind of stuff. And then I was thinking about doing this as a business. I happened to walk up the road and this house looked as though it was going to be sold. And I thought, no more golden nobles, which I didn't even know what they were at that point. Yeah. And actually it was people buying it and they were friends of the previous owner and were going to keep all the things that she'd held dear, including the tree. So I was then invited in to basically strip the tree, have their quince crop as well. That is where it started. It did all start with a golden noble, yeah.
And the quince is another fortuitous, I suppose. Is that the word? It's probably the longest word I've ever used. Because I was reading that pectin comes from quince, or is good from, as well as other apple pairings and things.
Yeah, there's lots of things that have pectin.
Yes. One of my questions was how you make your jams. Mm-hmm. Some people will keep it to a mixture of exactly fruit and sugar. And other people will insist on using things like pectin as well. And I just wondered how you make your jams.
Oh, okay. Well, depending on what fruit you use, you may have to add pectin, because if you've got cherries or rhubarb, I mean, you can cook them till the cows come home and it will never set. So you have to add pectin. Yeah. But things like stone fruits, apples, they've all got enough in to actually make a set. For sugar, yeah, you're right. Lots of people do equal fruit to sugar, but I don't like that because I think it just tastes, your product then tastes of sugar. Mm. So I like to keep it to the minimum that I can in order to comply with all food safety regulations and for it to have a decent shelf life and to taste nice. People like it actually. They like to, if you make dams and jam that's got a bit of a tang to it, that's what people want.
Yeah.
They want to be able to taste the fruit, not a big slug of sugar.
Is it the EU regulation where they insist jams to be 60% sugar, 40% fruit?
You've caught me out there, I'm not sure. It's not so much 60% sugar. You do this formulation, and I've just got an online tool, so don't ask me to work it out. I couldn't possibly do it. You can find out exactly how much you've used. So it's not that you use 40% fruit, 60% sugar. It's that you have to have a certain density, which you test on a refractometer, and that has to be 60.
A refractometer.
Yes,
I don't think I've seen one of these.
Device. It's a marvellous little lab device. Yeah. You can calibrate them to test anything, like the density of brine and it's a lab thing.
Yeah.
And you can use it to test the density of the sugar. And you can tell by using it if your jam will ever set, because if it's below 50, you're onto a loser. So you have to do something. You have to add sugar, a bit of pectin or something. You have to act. So yeah, it's really interesting. And you have to put the percentage that's read off your refractometer on your labels.
Yeah.
I've made so much jam, you can hear when it's there. You know when it's there, you can see it and you can hear it.
How can you hear it?
Oh, I don't know, the sound of the rolling changes. So it goes from being frothy to being much more bloopy, volcanic gloop. And at that point, you know you've got to the right 105, give or take. Yeah. And then you test it. Obviously, you don't just stick it straight in a jar, but there's lots of testing going on. I think one of the things that really surprised me when I first started trading was the amount of stories that people came up with. It was remarkable. Old ladies coming along and telling me about, well, in fact, giving me recipes, you know, actually handwriting out recipes that the things that their nans have made. There's a jam called High Dumpsy Deary, which is a silly name, but anyway, it's made at the end of the plum, apple and pear season, so it's to use up all three at the tail end of the crop when they're not that great. It's just a traditional thing to use up fruit that would otherwise go to the pigs. I mean that literally. She brought me a recipe that her mum had made during the war. Mm. Gooseberries, damsons, blackberries, all sorts of fruits like that. They really do something to people's minds. Oh, my nan used to make that. I'll have six of them. My nan made that and I haven't eaten it in 30 years. Those kinds of stories, just fantastic things. It's really lovely. You can hear people talk to each other in front of me about their kind of jam stories. It's just a really lovely way into family memories.
you must have your own jam stories as well. You started the business in 2016.
Yeah.
Last year was a very wet summer. Mm. This year is an incredibly dry, intense summer. My question is the effect that has on your jams, on the fruits. Mm. You must be subject to the same things as any other food production, just like a vinery.
Yeah, well, last year there were loads of apricots, so I made a lot of apricot jam, actually. Apricot and lavender jam, you should try it, it's delicious. And this year, my supplier had three apricots on his trees, which he gave to his wife. It's like, three apricots, excuse me. And I'd been buying trays for last year. I couldn't get quinces last year because there was a late frost in May and it walloped all of the quinces in my area, so I couldn't get any. This year, I think I'm going to be awash with them because there hasn't been a frost for, I think since April. So they're happy as Larry. So I'm planning my quince season as we speak.
Now, amongst your jams and your chutneys and jellies, one thing I was particularly interested in was the variety of flavours that you've put together. The one that springs to mind would be... as my mind goes blank, would be, I think it was plum and Earl Grey.
Yes.
I would never have thought of that in my life. Yeah, that's my interest, is how you get all these great complementary flavours.
It probably sounds really silly, but I can kind of taste those things before I can imagine what they taste like, and I can kind of taste if they're going to work. And I don't think I've had a real taste disaster. Like the damson and Earl Grey, or plum and Earl Grey, damsons go equally well with it, but you need a bit of orange just to make it extra nice. I just imagine it. Different things like tonka beans, which I am going to try later this year, actually. I think they'd be nice with plums.
Well, can we just describe tonka beans for anyone who doesn't know?
Well, I don't know loads about a tonka bean. It's a funny little thing, probably about the size of your thumbnail, which you grate very gingerly into whatever food you're making because it is very strong. Mm. It's one of those umami flavours, so you either like it or you really don't. Also, you've got to be selling to the right markets that will not just blank tonka bean on a label. Some people will just don't acknowledge what it is because they don't know what it is. It's surprising, actually. A lot of people don't know what greengages are. But that shocks me to my core that you don't know what a greengage is. But lots of people just don't see them.
Would that be younger people or...?
Not especially. And I wonder if that's people who've grown up in cities. Mm. I suppose it is mostly younger people, but they're kind of missing out, really. Damsons, again, that tends to be older people that know what that is, unless they're gran made damson jam.
I think gooseberries almost falls into that as well.
Gooseberries totally does, but they're quite a big seller, especially if you get international customers who'll say, what have you got that's typically English? Well, gooseberry and elderflower jam. So, yeah, I think culturally jam is kind of interesting. Oh, that sounds really silly, but I think it is really interesting, so I ought to write something about it. So going back to flavours, I also do quite a lot of research, so I've got this fantastic book called The Flavour Thesaurus, which is by Nikki Segnit, I don't know how to pronounce her surname. That's a really useful suggestion of why things go together, plum and almonds say. Fascinating book, absolutely endlessly interesting. I was looking at an apple, thought the little end bit, it's just like the end of a rose, I think they're in the same family, I bet they go together, and they do. So it's ideas like that that really, it's a lot of thinking, which I very much like. I really don't like to swamp the main flavour, so if it's orange for marmalade or it's plums for jam or whatever it is, whatever complement I use to that has got to come into your mouth later, if you see what I mean. So apricot and lavender jam, which is a truly sublime thing. When you eat some, you can taste the apricots very quickly in the front of your mouth and you think, okay, it's just apricot jam. And then as it moves through your mouth and down your throat, you go, oh, there's the lavender. And it's the same with gin marmalade. As long as you don't put too much gin in, you think, okay, nice marmalade, where's the gin? Ah, there's the gin. And that's what I really like, is like a food journey through your mouth. So if I can do that, some flavours, they're just so well matched that they kind of hit all the different bits of your tongue. And that's what I love, actually. I find that very inspiring.
Now, that was Amanda Randall of
And when you type this into a search engine, cambridge-preserves-kitchen.co.uk. And Amanda will be at the Riverside Tea Garden on Sunday, that's this Sunday, between 1 and 4pm with all of her jams, chutneys and jellies. And the Riverside Tea Garden is based at the Cambridge Museum of Technology site. You'll also find there'll be Prosecco and fresh bread on the go too. All her produce is vegan, dairy and gluten-free, and she's also going to start work on some diabetic ranges too.
What could be better than free food? News of free food available in Cambridge we get from the Olio app. And astonishingly, after talking about price hikes in food prices and the need, the desirability of free food, we've checked on the Olio app and today there isn't any. And this is extremely unusual, but it is worth checking. I mean, for one thing, Pret, the chain Pret-a-Manger, gets rid of all its surplus sandwiches and food via Olio. There are people in Cambridge who go and pick it up and they advertise it on the Olio app and you go round to their address or a place that's mutually convenient and pick it up. So it is worth getting the Olio app. And on the next favour, we hope there is actually some Olio news to bring you.
Yes.
So, as everyone knows by now, there is a new chef in charge at Alimentum in Hills Road, Samira Effer. Alan asked her about it and about what changes she is putting in place.
Samira, how does it feel to be in charge of Alimentum? It's a restaurant with such a history and yet recently, or fairly recently, lost its Michelin star. So how does it feel?
I think it feels all right. Like, I think people are thinking maybe I feel like a little bit overwhelmed by it all and that I really want to get the star back and all this kind of stuff, but it's completely not like that at all. I've got a lovely team, I'm working really closely with the sommelier, and the restaurant manager is my boyfriend, so it's all quite comfortable for me. I'm just in there just running the kitchen, and it's something that I've ran the kitchen here before 4 years ago, and then the last place I was working in Cornwall, I was basically running that. So it's quite, I'm not gonna say it's easy, but it's comfortable. I get to put things on the menu that I can put on, you know, I don't have to answer to someone above me or anything like that. So it's a nice experience for me, and the guys in the kitchen and the guys out front make it a lot easier because we all get on really well. So I think I'm enjoying it. I'm enjoying it a lot, yeah.
And what sort of things are you putting on the menu? You know, where's Alimentum going as far as food's concerned?
I put things on mainly things that I like to eat. So I'm very much, I like big, bold flavours, things like Thai food and Moroccan food, because I'm from a very different background. So my dad is from Nigeria, my mum is from Iran. So I've grown up eating a lot of different sorts of food and I go out to eat a lot. So I normally put things on the menu that I like to eat and what I think other people like to eat.
Right. And do the customers like to eat it, or is it...
Of course,
Is it too big a change? I mean, that must be something you're cautious about.
I don't think it's too big a change. I think change is good. I think because when I first started, there was things on the menu at Alimentum that were on when I was here 4 years ago, and I think it's nice to have a change. I think it's better to keep customers coming back if you keep changing the things on the menu so they can see different things. It's nice. I like changing the menu often, and to be honest, like, I'll put a dish on and like within a month I'll probably get bored of it and then I'll change it.
So what's on now that you're really pleased with?
I've put a couple of new dishes on last week. I actually put three new dishes on last week. Pork jowl, a Moroccan pork jowl and cheek dish, and that's a really nice dish. It's on lunch menus. It was actually really popular. I didn't think it was going to be as popular as it was. We actually ran out of the weekend, which was really like annoying but also good. So yeah, it's Moroccan pork jowl and cheek, and it's served with bulgur wheat and pomegranate and some feta and a bit of mint. I like light dishes. I'm not too much myself as a fan of big, like, heavy food, but there will always be something on the menu for people that can like that kind of thing. And then I put a couple of new desserts on as well. I take inspiration from other desserts. So the coffee dish I put on is towards tiramisu. So it's a mascarpone panna cotta, and it's just served with like coffee cake and coffee curd, and there's some orange in there as well, so that's a really nice dish. I'm really proud of that one so far. I think at the moment there's two standout dishes on the menu that the customers always give feedback on, and that's the pollock dish, which I've got on. And then it's really, really simple. It's really light. It's just a cured piece of pollock, which has been charred, and it's topped with a thin layer of lardo, and it's served with peas, tarama salata, and some lettuce and some sea vegetables, and it's really simple, and people seem to love it. So that's a really nice dish. And then my other dish is something that I wanted to put on because I wanted to use Yorkshire tea, because I'm from Yorkshire. I wanted something, I like to have something on there that's sort of related to me. So the lemon cheesecake dessert is that. So, and everyone seems to love that as well. So they're probably the main dishes.
And what's the best thing you've ever eaten?
It's a really hard question because I eat out a lot. Like, I've probably spent way too much money on eating out. But more recently, I've been to Gareth Ward's hotel restaurant in Wales, and his food is amazing. And I've been there twice now, and it's always hard for me to say that I would go back to a Michelin-starred restaurant. Most of the time, it's you go there once and you experience it, and that's it, you go somewhere else. But that is a restaurant that I would always go back to because his food is insane, and I would definitely go back. You know, it's just, he just does like, it's very small dishes, and it's all like one mouthful dishes, but each mouthful is just, it's just amazing. And I think probably the favorite dish that I was there the last time, he did a beef burger dish, and it was just, it was amazing.
Now, you mentioned working closely with the sommelier.
It's nice to work with him because he's very much interested in both sides of it. When I put new dishes on the menu, you know, we'll always try them together. I think it's a big importance to people that come to eat that they always want to have a dish that goes with a nice wine.
Your love of big, bold flavours, is that shared by your chefs? I mean, are they on board with the direction?
It's nice for them to see something different. It's keeping them interested in working here. If, you know, they're all young people, so they're all here to learn new things. So the more I change the menu with things that they haven't always seen before, different flavours and things like that. So I think it's good for them, as well as good for me, and as well as good for the customers to see something different.
So you're having to do a fair bit of training, are you, in the kitchen?
I am, yeah. Yeah, they're all fairly new. Apart from one of them, they've all been here with me for about 4 months. But it's nice. It's a nice atmosphere in the kitchen. It's a lot more relaxed, and it's nice for them because I'm here all the time. We close 2 days a week, so it's the same team every day. But unless someone goes on holiday, it's the same. It's the same team every day, so we're all pretty close. So it's good. I know.
The Sunday supper clubs, they're still running, aren't they?
They're still running, but I don't want it to anymore. What I'm wanting to do is change the Sunday supper club to chef nights. So I'm wanting to invite a chef in to come and do like a collaboration menu. So the same as what we're doing with supper club, but instead of it being supper club, which is something that Mark brought into, I want to change it so I can invite chefs that I know and chefs locally, and so they can showcase what they're doing as well as what we're doing. And I think that would be good for the team as well, because they get to work with a different chef. So I think that's what we're going to do. So the next supper club is 5th of August. That will still be a supper club. And then hopefully the next, probably in December, I think now, hopefully that will be a chef night.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a really nice direction.
Yeah.
That sounds really interesting. And like you say, good for the staff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Samira.
Thank you.
Yeah, that was Samira Effa there from Alimentum. And the atmosphere in there was really nice. There was just this bonhomie, just people getting on with their work, but getting on well. It was very nice. And Samira also said that she's thinking about changing the way the decor, I suppose, in Alimentum, which I think you're not terribly keen
on. It's a little dark. Mm. A little dark, yes. It needs a bit of lightening in some way. I'm not sure. Yeah. It'd be fascinating to see how she does it.
But, you know, the food is great, of course.
Indeed.
And that music signals, of course, time for the latest food tweets from the city.
Yeah, there's been a few tweets today. The Beer Garden is opening today slightly later than usual, and that's at 4 p.m. And today they're joined by Honest Burgers for the first time and Chihuahua's Mexican Street Food, both serving from 6 o'clock. La Latina Bustamante is serving now. That's just off Cowley Road. And at the Gog Farm Shop, Druv Baker, winner of MasterChef in 2010, is there today showcasing his new charcuterie range.
Well, as we all know, it's another hot day today, and one person who won't mind that at all is Jack Van Prague, he of Jack's Gelato in Bennett Street. Now, we ran his story a few years ago, but if you're a more recent convert of Jack's, here's a snippet.
You didn't start off by making ice cream, did you? Because at one point, weren't you working for Cotto, or had an involvement with Cotto?
It's funny, actually. Ice cream was actually one of the first things that I ever made about nearly 30 years ago when I was a small child at my mother's knee. But no, professionally, I've had a career in professional kitchens, which most of it I specialised in pastry section, but I also ran whole kitchens and...
At one point, you co-owned Cotto.
Yeah, my career's taken me to lots of different places. I ran and co-owned Cotto for the first 3 years.
So when would that have been? What sort of time was that?
2005 to 2008. And then we sold it to Hans and Ruth, and I went to cook at Chez Panisse in California, and then I moved to France and cooked in France for a couple of years before moving back to Cambridge to start Jack's Gelato in 2011.
But before Cotto, was there anything before Cotto?
Before Cotto, I did my apprenticeship at the Pink Geranium, which was in Melbourne. I worked there for 3 years from apprentice commis up to senior sous chef. Prior to that, I worked in different kitchens in Canada, which is where I started cooking originally on a whim when I was travelling. That's when it all started, really.
And how do you feel now about having left the restaurant scene? Because life in restaurants must be extraordinarily intense and possibly a bit trying at the time, but is it not something that sometime after you've left it behind, you miss it? Are you hankering after returning?
I am. It is something that is often on my mind. I mean, restaurant work is that kind of curious combination of exhaustion and exhilaration, and I do miss the buzz sometimes. And you know, I cooked with Rosie on a part-time basis for a while at Fitzbillies when they first did their reopening. It's something I'll be looking to return to.
Yes, well, that was Jack of Jack's Gelato in Bennett Street, 2014. And I think the idea of going back to restaurants has really been overtaken by the success of his business. There is some talk about him opening a place in London.
We talked about food prices going up earlier. Here's Dave Fox of Trumington Allotments talking about what you can still sow if you want to grow your own and how to try and make it work in these dry conditions.
Ordinarily, we'd still look at sowing things like carrot and fennel, last chance saloon for those really, but get them in now and there's a good chance that they'll have enough time to produce a sizeable crop. Turnips, radish, lettuce, salads like lettuce and rocket and chicory, they can go in now. The problem is that it's just so dry that they are going to need water. So yeah, you're going to have to soak the seed, get it to germinate and look after it. One might also hope that we could plant out things like, certainly brassicas, but also leeks, and start to think about overwintering onions. I sowed seed of these outside with a view to planting them out, planting seedlings out now, and of course those seeds didn't germinate because I didn't get enough water on them. And so I must admit I've just acquired a few strips of veg plants from the garden centre in order to get some overwintering crops in. So there's plenty that can be done, but if you sow outside, I think we're going to have to water because it doesn't look like there's much rain forecast now for another week or so.
Right. Well, in the early parts of the year when the weather is inclement and not suitable for sowing seeds, we start off indoors. Are there any of those things we could start off indoors in the hope that they will get underway, but in the hope that we'll be able to plant them out?
Yeah, certainly worth a try with lettuce, for example. You can also try things like carrot and fennel, but the nature of the root of those is that it's a tap root and they really don't like getting transplanted. So in that case, sow them in a deep plug tray so that you can remove a whole plug of compost with the root ball and not to disturb it too much as you put it in the soil. So maybe that's the way to go, the umbellifers at least. And you can always put some radishes in. I mean, that's cheerful. That's a cheap crop almost any time of the year. And failing that, of course, maybe this is good news for the garden centres and the online gardening catalogues. Buy the seedlings, get them in. See, I mean, the ones I got from a local garden centre a couple of days ago were maybe only 5 centimetres tall, so ideally I'd grow them on a little bit before planting them out. And certainly the ones, of course, that arrive by post, by their nature, they have to be quite small. And certainly this one company is marketing seedlings of such a size that they can go through a standard letterbox. So that's obviously a selling point because it means you don't have to wait in for a delivery or go and collect it from a collection point or something. So small seedlings, you might need to grow them on before planting them out.
And in the future, Dave, long hot summers aren't going to go away and they could very well become the norm.
No, that's what we're being told. That's what we're being told, isn't it? Well, I'm not going to give up on annual veg. But their weakness is that they need to do the whole thing in, 6 months, really. You know, we start planting in March and harvest most things by September, October. And if there's going to be a prolonged dry spell like this, then a lot of those plants just aren't going to make it. And on the plus side, the few that do get through might be absolute crackers. I mean, I've only got 6 parsnips this year, having sown 2 entire beds, but I'll bet those are the strong ones which have sought deep for the water, and maybe even there'll be a couple of champion parsnips in there. We won't know until November. But seriously, I think that we ought to be looking towards planting more perennials, by which we mean something that's expected to last for three seasons or more. Because they, once they're established, they've got a stronger root system and they're going to be more resilient against periods of drought.
What sort of thing? That rules out a huge number
unfortunately.
Types of vegetables.
Yeah, okay, but being positive, it means we can do strawberries. So that's something I'm going to be looking at this week, actually, is identifying some nice runners off these 3 varieties of strawberry which I grow and make sure I've got those potted up. And perhaps I'll leave some of the older rows of strawberries in, and I might end up doing 12. I normally do 9 rows of strawberries, but I think I might do 12 now, just so I've got a greater proportion of my land on something. And I've never had a strawberry crop fail. Mm. Or perhaps maybe when there's been a late frost once, actually, which took all the flowers. But yeah, the strawberries are fairly reliable, and of course that's something which one can preserve for winter use. So even though you only get sort of 3 or 4 weeks of pickings, you can make jam, and also, I also like them dehydrated, which are great in muesli and so on. So that's something you can eat all year round if you get enough of them.
Mm. Well, it's another thing to look at. I mean, you mentioned overwintering onions. Overwintering crops, like putting in your broad beans in October or November and rather than in spring.
Certainly, yeah. So, of course, the advantage of the overwintering crops is they tend to get plenty of moisture, and if they're hardy enough to survive the low temperatures, which the broad beans and onions all seem to be,
they're the obvious ones.
Spring cabbage is another one. So I've just sowed some seed, so it's about the right time to sow seed for spring cabbage now, pointy types and round types, and you would expect them to grow quite quickly if they get some wet, and plant them out as seedlings by the first week of September. And don't forget to protect them, of course, from the ever hungry pigeons, and also the butterflies will still be around at that time as well. And then they They don't do much over the winter, as far as you can see, but they are developing a root system, of course. So hopefully by the time the warm weather comes, they'll have a well-established root system, and they'll have enough oomph to make a nice, tight, large cabbage head, which I harvested my last one just a few weeks ago, actually. So even though they're called spring cabbage, they're sort of tend to be sort of early summer cabbage for me. So yeah, that's a good idea, getting some autumn crops in. So that means that as you harvest summer crops, or gaze wistfully at what could have been an empty patch of land, and think about getting something in nice and early that will get through the winter and then make a nice early start the next season. And getting back to perennials, what about some asparagus? Now, who doesn't like asparagus? So that's something to plan for planting out next spring, March, April. But if you want to do that, then because asparagus really doesn't like weed competition, it would be a really good idea to start weeding a bed and get it ready. And also don't plan to grow anything else in that bed for the next 20 years, because asparagus is a long-term crop. But once it's established, it's quite reliable, as long as you keep the weeds under control. And then, of course, for even longer-lasting perennials, we can think of fruit trees, even nut trees as well. So if you're...
What nut trees grow well?
Well, I'm growing hazel. I love hazelnuts. Unfortunately, the squirrels love them even more and tend to get to them first. But we also get a decent crop of hazels out of our hedge. So I don't know whether there are cultivar or commoner garden hazels, but I've got three named varieties up there, which are very nice. Unfortunately, as I say, the squirrels seem to get most of them, but I shall try to be there a day earlier than them. Yeah. This autumn, and walnuts, of course, when they grow, but that's an enormous tree. It may be that the small cultivars of walnuts, I don't know. It might be worth looking into that.
What about the state of the soil? Can we make the soil much more moisture retentive, or is the top few centimetres always going to dry out, so shallow rooted plants are always going to suffer?
Well, you do what you can, so, you know, incorporating moisture-retentive material is the standard recommended method, by which we mean a compost or manure or even spent compost out of your tomato pots or houseplant pots. Anything you can get, really. And I'm always recommending that people mulch. On our land at Trumpington Allotments, where it's a very light, sandy soil, you can't get enough organic matter on it. It does tend to disappear quite quickly. But I think that's because our crops are taking it up and using it. You do have to keep putting it on. And one of my neighbouring plots, there's quite a step down from the path to the level of his soil, and he's been there many decades now, actually, and I believe that's because he doesn't put very much organic matter on. He continues to take great crops off it, so that's brilliant. I'm sure he's using chemical fertilizers to achieve that, but the organic matter is going down because I don't think he's taking soil away, he's taking biomass away, so that's why.
Many thanks to Dave Fox from Trumpington Allotments.
Yeah, and also thanks to Dave Fox, because on his plot he has a mulberry tree, and this year it has fruited for the first time. And that is the first time I've ever had mulberries, and they are fantastic, and you never see them on sale. Marvellous.
So, from mulberries to green onions, signalling the start of our news section, and we begin with jobs.
The Petersfield in Sturton Street is looking for a chef de partie. Closing date is 28th of August, and the Waterman, as well, at 32 Cheston Road, wants a sous chef. You can apply for these positions on the City Pub Group's website.
A chef de partie is needed at the White Brasserie in the Boot at Histon, and again, you can apply online, this time at the White Brasserie website.
A call for volunteers now. Cambridge Sustainable Food is running a cookery workshop for the local community in Buchan Street Neighbourhood Centre. They need volunteers to work with the workshop leader to welcome attendees, set up and assist with the session, and tidy up afterwards. Dates are the 7th, 9th and 14th of August. You can go to cambridgesustainablefood.org and click on Get Involved for details and to apply.
Parker's Tavern is now open in the University Arms Hotel for breakfast, lunch, afternoon tea and dinner. And I visited it for their soft opening, and it is well worth a visit. Gorgeous food.
I'm going for the third time.
Oh, nice, nice, lucky.
Right, on to plum news. Bushel Box Farm in Willingham is the place to go if you are a plum fanatic in pursuit of unusual varieties, which I am. They're by no means all available yet, they're not all ripe, but this week they had Opal, Early Rivers, Mertia and Herman plums. I am paying them a visit. They also have a cafe at weekends that serves Hot Numbers coffee, Candula tea and Marimba hot chocolate, along with homemade cakes.
Now here's a way to get the money to start up your own food business, or to develop the one you already have, perhaps by moving from street food to running your own cafe or restaurant. This is all linked to a forthcoming BBC Two series called Million Pound Menu. And if you want to find out more, you can visit the website at electricray.com.
Bread making classes are beginning at Newnham Cafe Bakery, the first Sunday of the month beginning in September. You'll be learning to bake sourdough, as well as Italian and Scandinavian breads. They run from 9:30 to 4:30 with professional artisan baker Mahala LeMay. For more details and to book, go to Know Your Loaf on Eventbrite. And if you have any queries, email doughclubclasses@gmail.com.
And we hear that a Fanny Craddock-like figure is on her travels in September.
Oh, she is indeed. Fanny is going to be appearing at the Market Drayton Ginger and Spice Festival, because Market Drayton is the home of gingerbread and where Clive of India is buried. It's North Shropshire, and Fanny is going to be doing her lunchtime thing with a bit of ginger and a bit of spice on the 29th of September.
Good. Right. I hope it goes well.
Thank you.
Right, that's all we have time for today. I bet you wish you could hear it all over again. Well, you can. We're on alternative Saturdays at noon. By the way, we are moving from noon to 1 p.m. from September. We're repeated on Sundays at 2 and podcast early the following week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us, flavour@cambridge105.co.uk, or contact us on Twitter, @flavour105. Coming up next this Sunday afternoon, it's the Eclectic Light Show. Mandy Morton and Nicola Upson are presenting their two-hour special from the Cambridge Folk Festival. At 5 p.m, it's Polish Waves, bringing Polish culture to Cambridge with a mix of views, news, entertainment and music presented in English and Polish. At 6, it's From the Terraces, Tim Armitage and the team reviewing the football action from Cambridge United, Cambridge City and Histon Town. And then at 7 p.m, Chris Stewarden is here to present 8 out of 10 tracks. This is looking at the musical connections that link bands across the spectrum. Featuring tonight a panel of Cambridge musicians, DJs and fans, such as Dan Carney from Model Village and Fuzzy Lights, Ellie Clark from Slate the Disco, Beck Conway from Sweet Revenge, Ian Perry from False Adults, and Tom Taylor from our very own Stagger. Jackie Bond returns at 8 with another edition of Let the Good Times Roll, and then at 9 it's Rebel Arts Radio, and following that is Stagger at 10. Stagger is the alternative music show with rap, electronica and experimental music presented by Tom Taylor, David Cunnington and Ian Shaw. And from 11 to midnight, Lee Chambers is here with Bookmark, the fortnightly show featuring Cambridge-based writers. So we have plenty to keep you going right through your Sunday. And that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 18th of August. So, until then, we wish you good eating and...
Goodbye!